standing on the river where the house just recently washed away, and there's a pretty good ripping current coming along right here near the shore.
The Matanuska River claims one home and may take others. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 24th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott presses the case for river protection from Canadian mines.
It was clear in my meetings with both the State Department and the Canadian counterpart that they view this as a relatively local issue.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Matanuska River has taken a toll on personal property in the Sutton area in recent days. One 16 by 20 foot home has fallen into the river yesterday, and three other outbuildings have also toppled into the water so far. Matanuska Susitna Borough Assemblyman Jim Sykes, who represents the area, says the problem is caused by water from the river seeking a new path due to gravel piling up in its normal channel.
Standing on the river where the house just recently washed away, looking downstream, and there's a pretty good ripping current coming along right here near the shore. And what I see downstream is that water is washing into the trees. So it's creating, it looks like an island, and just working its way inward.
The affected area is about 6 miles north of Sutton, where the Glen Highway runs close to the river's northern bank. Sykes says the river level is not overly high, but glacial melt is adding to the river's strength. The gravel piling up on the south side of the river has pushed the water to the north side, and that is threatening homes close to the north banks. Casey Cook, the borough's emergency services manager, says 6 families are on alert that they may have to move quickly.
So they need to have a plan, and they need to have all their important documents and pictures and those types of things that they don't want to have to worry about losing. Those should be either made ready to go or, you know, waiting in the car so that they can leave if the water gets higher or if it continues to erode down.
Cook says there are no injuries from the erosion. He says the people who may be evacuating have made plans for places to stay, and the borough does not have to open an emergency shelter. Sykes says the braided Matanuska River has caused erosion of its banks in the past. He says the borough does not have sufficient funds or the ability to do a prevention project that is likely to succeed. Alaska critics of British Columbia mines probably won't get any help from a cross-boundary panel that they've been lobbying to take on their concerns. The International Joint Commission addresses U.S.-Canada water conflicts. Critics say it should take up the possibility that mines near the border will pollute rivers key to southeast Alaska fisheries. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott says he spoke with officials during a recent trip to Washington, D.C.
It was clear in my meetings with both the State Department and the Canadian counterpart that they view this as a relatively local issue, that certainly the federal governments have a role, but essentially it is Alaska to BC.
Mallott heads up a multi-agency task force considering the state's response to transboundary mine concerns. He traveled to British Columbia in May to meet with provincial leaders, as well as tribal and business leaders. One was Mines Minister Bill Bennett, who committed to a Southeast Alaska trip. Mallott says that will be August 24th through the 26th. He plans to school Bennett in regional economic and environmental issues.
And to impress upon him even more firmly the requirement that these transboundary rivers never have issues of downstream pollution and other degradation resulting from development on the BC side of the border.
The Lieutenant Governor and his Transboundary Mines Task Force will also host meetings of tribal, fisheries, tourism, and other groups August 5th and 6th in Juneau. The parent company of Alaska Airlines reported its highest quarterly profit in its history yesterday, despite stiff competition. Delta Airlines continues to expand on Alaska's home turf. Alaska Air Group CEO Brad Tilden told Wall Street analysts his carrier is doubling down on service to hold its rival at bay.
As we pause to take a look at how we're doing mid-year and 2.5 years into the biggest competitive incursion we've seen in a while, I'm happy to share that we are thriving. Our operation is firing on all cylinders.
Alaska Air executives say they're maintaining market share at SeaTac Airport, which both Alaska and Delta now claim as a key hub. Delta has begun flying to Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan, which had only been served by Alaska Airlines. The brisk growth by both carriers seems to be coming at an expense of other airlines serving the Northwest, such as United and Southwest. Delta executives say they're bullish about the performance of their new Pacific Gateway during their own earnings conference call a few days ago. City of Fairbanks voters will consider a 5% sales tax on marijuana. The City Council has approved putting the proposed retail tax before voters in the October municipal election. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the tax is an effort to tap unknown revenue that legalized marijuana sales could provide.
The marijuana tax ordinance's sponsor, Fairbanks City Council member David Pruse, told the panel that the levy follows on direct language from the statewide ballot initiative approved by Alaska voters last fall, legalizing recreational marijuana.
This is what the industry wanted. They want to be treated like alcohol. We're treating them just like alcohol.
The city of Fairbanks already has alcohol and tobacco taxes. Pruse further advocated for the proposed marijuana sales tax as an alternative means for the city to raise money to help cover a dip in property tax revenue.
What we have to do is make the decision, do we want to put this in its operating form before the voters and let them decide.
A version of the tax ordinance that would have allowed the rate to be set anywhere between 5% and 8% was turned back by the council after concerns were raised by council member Jerry Cleworth about compliance with the city charter.
It specifically says that if we're going to set a rate, then go to the voters, and that's what we're doing. But if we're going to raise that rate, we should go to the voters again.
Local cannabis advocate Frank Turney spoke out against the proposed marijuana sales tax, saying it will have a negative effect.
Pushing people into the black market, so to speak.
Turney and two other citizens who voiced opposition to the tax at the council meeting also cited a $50 per ounce state tax that will be levied on marijuana growers. No one from the marijuana industry testified. The state is still formulating regulations governing commercial marijuana. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Bethel City Council pushes back on alcohol.
It doesn't seem like the ABC board is going to uphold our ability to control our own community.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message is sponsored by APU.
The Bethel City Council is appealing the State Alcoholic Beverage Control Board's rejection of their protest of the Bethel Native Corporation's packaged liquor store application. The council met in executive session last evening for 3.5 hours. The ABC board on July 1st called the city's protest of the proposed Bethel Spirits license arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable, sparking outrage from the council. The board is required to uphold the protests unless they meet those criteria. Mayor Rick Robb says he's personally in favor of local sales.
But I do not think that the protest was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. I think the protest was valid based on community standards, debate, process, public hearings, past votes, planning on having future votes. All those things were taken into consideration. So the protest was very well thought out.
The board has not decided on the status of the license and plans a public hearing in Bethel after the October election, in which citizens will again advise the council on whether they want to see a liquor license of some variety. And in that same election, it's possible that voters could choose to go back to local option with a city-run store. In the council's next meeting, they could introduce a move to hold a binding vote in October on the possibility of opening a city-run liquor store through local option. Councilman Rick Herman. Chuck Herman is sponsoring the action and cited local control.
And especially now with this uncertainty over what we can do as a community, that's really what at this moment I think forced my hand was, I don't believe we have the power anymore. It doesn't seem like the ABC board is going to uphold our ability to control our own community. And I think the only way we can get that power back is by going towards this local option with the ability to have a city-run liquor store.
Before it goes to voters, the measure must make its way through the council. The city did away with local option in 2009. Citizens, in an advisory vote in 2010, rejected several types of liquor license, and the city successfully protested several licenses. Citizens again rejected going back into local option in May of that year. For now, October is shaping up to be a busy month, and the timing of the city's appeal. The board hasn't formally issued their finding to the city, which they need before proceeding. Leif Albertson is Bethel's vice mayor.
The stage that we're at right now is we directed council to appeal the protest, and they're going to put together what they feel like is a good appeal, and that's going to involve legal research.
The vote is October 6th. A plan to bring land-based high-speed internet to the western interior is moving forward this summer. GCI's Terranet uses hilltop repeater sites to pass microwave signals along the ground rather than sending the signals to satellites in space. The system is already in operation in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region and around Bristol Bay, but GCI is eager to get Terranet up and running in the western interior because it's the final phase in a process the company calls closing the ring. GCI spokesman David Morris explains once all Terranet sites are connected in a loop and linked up with GCI's high-speed fiber optic lines around Anchorage and Fairbanks, internet services get faster and fixing problems become simpler.
Because once you have a ring, then you've effectively doubled the capacity on the Terra network. Right now, because it's single thread, we have to have satellite backup for it. The amount of capacity that you can put on a hybrid microwave fiber system is just significantly more than what you'll find on satellites. So once we get the ring, then that creates the abilities to switch traffic in either direction in the event that there is a break, so that the traffic remains in service.
The Terranet repeater sites are located about 50 miles apart down the Yukon River corridor, where GCI has to connect its existing system around Kotzebue to fiber optic lines near Nenana. Six sites are planned for construction in the next phase of the Terranet build-out, including the last crucial backbone sites between Galena and Buckland, which will close the Terranet ring. In addition to the backbone sites, Terranet has spur lines that would extend the network to outlying villages. The seed money for Terranet came through an $88 million stimulus program grant and loan package. But Moore says federal funding has come and gone, and now the company is financing the project out of its own pocket.
That was a one and done. And so that's what allowed the initial part of Terranet to get distributed from Anchorage to the Bethel region. And so there's been a little bit of extra money that's come in from the government, but that was mostly to extend it just to Unalakleet. So everything beyond that is at-risk capital. In other words, it's just money from the company.
Morris says Terranet has become so popular in Western Alaska that GCI is already having to upgrade its equipment to handle the demand and improve service. Representatives from four agencies arrived in the community of Wales recently, equipped with 40 pizzas and a slideshow on polar bear deterrence. It was one of the final meetings in a years-long effort to start a polar bear patrol in the Seward Peninsula Village, with help from the Alaska Nanook Commission, the North Slope Borough, the World Wildlife Fund, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. KNOM's Laura Craigle has more.
Events kicked off on June 14th with a pizza party for the Wales community and continued all week with training sessions and discussions of patrol logistics. There is not a huge number of polar bears passing through Wales, but the community has had several close encounters. During one session, people shared stories of opening the front door to find a polar bear just outside, or even seeing one bear chase a teacher into the school. For Christine Komanasiak, school safety is a key reason for creating the patrol. She's a cook at the Wales school and says she worries about students during the winter when they walk to class in the dark.
The kids who have been beating me to work, I want the safety for them because they walk from up here to down there. The bears have been spotted by parsonage, by school. The one that they last killed, I spotted that one below the house eating on a walrus. That was the one they killed by the playground.
The patrol's mission is to minimize conflicts between people and polar bears for the safety of both. If bears do enter the community, the patrol will scare them away with noise, light, or non-lethal ammunition. Protecting the people comes first, but conserving the bear population is important too, given their status as a threatened species and their role as a subsistence resource. When the volunteer patrol starts, as early as December, Greg Oxrock will be on the squad. He says creating a patrol in Wales just makes sense as a proactive safety measure.
Safety should be number one, especially with somewhere like this where it's rural and it's hard to get transportation and facilities. It's good to try to stop a problem before it starts. It just makes sense to protect and try to serve our community.
For now, details are still being discussed. Where the patrol will be based, when it'll sweep the town's perimeter, and how many patrollers will be on duty at a time. While the agencies are providing equipment like ammunition, radios, and a snow machine, the Wales community will manage the patrol itself. The IRA will take the lead, but the City Council and the Wales Native Corporation are also involved, with all three bodies recommending patrollers for the job. Jack O'Melick, Executive Director of the Nanuk Commission, emphasizes the patrol is a Wales initiative. The community makes the decisions, and the agencies are there to help with training and supplies.
We get our authority to work on your behalf from you. We don't just take it upon ourselves to do it. And so we need to be informed, and people need to be involved.
That includes letting traditional knowledge shape the patrol's strategy. Craig Perham, a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, encouraged patrollers to work with elders and learn how the community has dealt with polar bears for generations.
Certainly there are biologists like myself in Anchorage that we could help when we can, but you've got that experience right here, you know, the older guys who've been out hunting.
Oxrock, who's 30, says he looks forward to connecting with elders through the patrol, especially since he doesn't have much firsthand experience with hunting or warding off polar bears.
There is a generation gap, and this might help dispel some of that distance between like the older generation and like my generation. The more we work together, the more we can grow as a whole.
The four agencies will evaluate the Wales Polar Bear Patrol once it's up and running to identify what works and what doesn't. O'Melick says they're treating it as a pilot program for a polar bear management plan that will develop over 10 years and cover the Bering Strait region. Reporting in Wales, I'm Laura Craigle.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Flower Power. 80 years ago, Verna Pratt was more comfortable with the violets and buttercups of rural Massachusetts than with people, but her early affection for flowers led her on an unexpected path to notoriety more than 3,000 miles away. KSKA's Ann Hillman joined Pratt for an Alaska Geographic class on wildflowers of the Chugach.
Clad in four shades of purple, Verna Pratt stands next to a patch of tangled grasses and plants, pointing at the only tiny spots of color. Her shock of white hair, wide round glasses, and deep smile lines are the only indicators of her 84 years. A group of women surround her, pencils poised to jot down the Latin names and descriptions of plants.
The scientific name is Campanula rotundifolia, and it gets that name from this little basal leaf. And I don't call it round.
Pratt's laughter punctuates the end of most of her sentences, sometimes seeming to say, silly botanists, why name it that? The class of 11 women pull out their tiny magnifying lenses to inspect the details of a Sitka pernat.
Well, it's just so fun cool.
Ooh, it smells lovely.
I know.
You have to get your nose close to look with this. So yeah.
That's Gretchen Hazen, a self-described Verna groupie, who's taken four different classes with Pratt and has been tracking flower sightings in her copy of Pratt's Field Guide to Alaskan Wildflowers for almost two decades. Pratt's self-published book will soon be on its 16th printing and has sold more than 100,000 copies. Walking past Byron Creek, Pratt is still processing the palpable group adoration.
Actually, it's gratifying. At first it's almost embarrassing, but then eventually it's gratifying because you can see that they're enjoying themselves and they're feeling good about the fact that they can identify something.
When she was younger, Pratt never foresaw this as her future.
I was practically almost a dropout in elementary school. I didn't even try until I got high school. I finally woke up.
But even then, she wasn't known as outgoing at the tiny school that she attended from kindergarten until graduation.
I'm a little farm girl. I was so shy and backwoodsy that it was terrible.
When she was a sophomore, a new boy joined the class, Frank Pratt, and 5 years later they married. When he joined the military, she left her rural Massachusetts home with its fields of vegetables and a roadside produce stand for Detroit and the New Orleans. Every place they went, she took her children to parks and sought out the green spaces.
That's what kept me going, was learning the plants wherever I went. And once I got through the first move, I think that first move was tough. But after that, I just went out searching for new plants. It became an obsession.
When they moved to Alaska in 1966, plants began taking over her life. Pratt says the flowers were so different from home, she was quickly entranced. Her husband soon realized that he couldn't compete with the flowers for her time, so he'd better start taking photos of them. Eventually, she started teaching classes, but it was difficult because there weren't any easy-to-use identification guides.
I was listening to people's gripes. That's how I decided how to organize the book. They kept saying, organize it so we can recognize things without having to go through a lot of education and study to get there.
So her husband helped her use their son's computer to compile the color-coded flower guide, then used money from a small inheritance and a second loan on their house to self-publish the book in 1989. They weren't sure how many copies.
The first book, we couldn't agree, and I said 10,000. My husband just about fainted. He said 5,000. I said, no, got to be more than that. We printed 7,500 and had to reprint in a month. And I'm like, oh, geez.
They went on to write three other guides in a children's book. Pratt has spoken about plants in the U.S. and abroad and is considered by many enthusiasts to be an expert. But with only a high school education, Pratt says she'll never officially hold that title. She can't rename plants to more accurately reflect their genus or get any credit for identifying a new species.
I mean, is that frustrating to you?
No. No, I know where I belong.
And where is that?
I'm just above you guys.
But at that, her groupies just laugh. To them, Pratt's on a level she probably can't imagine. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 49 Voices, where we'll meet another Verna. Verna Haynes runs the Anchorage store Obsession Records with her husband, Steve. The born and raised Alaskan couple had almost 20,000 LPs at one point. That's when they decided they should share their love of vinyl with everyone.
We had a huge collection, and we just really enjoyed chasing records. And we got to know a lot of the audiophile community here in Anchorage and develop some friendships. And everybody would say, well, when are you going to open a store? So we just did. I personally don't have an attachment to the records. My husband is a completely another story. When we first started the store, and it was a lot of his own personal collection going out the door, there was some separation anxiety that went on, but he worked through it. When you put on a record and you're listening to, let's say, 8 to 12 songs on a record, you're sort of committing to that record. A lot of people they're moving faster than that. And so they like the digital world, the digital sound and that kind of thing. It works for their lifestyle. And there's no harm, no foul on that. It's just, we're all at different places. We all want different things. I do hear people that used to listen to vinyl. They'll say something like, oh, I love the crackle and the snap, and I love to hear that kind of background noise. We really don't want to hear a whole lot of that, because it probably means that you need to clean your record. But I know where they're coming from, because it means something to them. It brings back a memory. It takes them back to a place in time. When you have a digital download, you don't actually have anything in your hand. You have something in your iPod, but you didn't actually get to appreciate the story behind the music or the artwork and sometimes the lyrics. I mean, it's just with the vinyl, it's all right there. And people love that. It adds an element to their appreciation for music.
Verna and Steve Haynes run the Anchorage store Obsession Records. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ann Hellman and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tom Bonsi in Spokane, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Men Matheson in Bethel, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Laura Craigle in Nome. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
And by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at crowleyalaska.com.
Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.